Overlooking Phoenix, from high above in the Star Worldwide Network studios, Badge Boys. Stories, insight, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. And now, here they are, the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to another episode of The Badge Boys, a show where two retired cops talk to the community. I'm retired Crime Stopper Sergeant Darren Birch.
I'm retired Phoenix Police Officer Jason Schechterly.
So I don't know how much you remember about the Big Bear manhunt. My involvement was microscopic, but I was a Crime Stopper Sergeant in the greater Phoenix area at the time. And I want to say it was San Bernardino County, as well as LA County, reached out to me and wanted help. So they were giving me some of the details. But do you remember this case?
I remember it only from headlines on the news and the shock value of who was involved.
Yeah, an ex-cop.
Yeah.
And when you say, and I knew a little bit about the backstory of this individual. And he was scary in the sense that he was military. He was a Navy Reserve officer. He had, you know, some weapon background. He was college educated. He was a running back for his university. This guy had potentially a good career until he went to LAPD, was in training mode with his a female FTO. They went on a call, just a call we've gone to a million times. It was at a hotel, and it was a 918 call, disturbed individual. He was schizophrenic, and they got him the help he needed. Then later, the female training officer put in a bad review on Christopher Dorner. That sparked his retaliation, which is what the department believes, or at least his training officer. And he accused her of kicking the psychiatric patient in the chest as an excessive force prior to securing him and getting him to the proper medical facility. That went full blown. There was a hearing. He was represented by a Lieutenant Kwan, and that ultimately resulted in his termination. So, because LAPD was looking at either they're going to discipline the female training officer for excessive force or the false allegation, lying by the trainee, and they opted the latter, and he was terminated. What I love on this show, this special, is that we have a retired LAPD commander, Ed Prokop, who is going to talk about some of the specifics in terms of maybe a little bit about that, but more about the ensuing manifesto, the all points bulletin, the manhunt, and then sadly, the killings. So without further ado, we bring in retired commander with LAPD, Ed Prokop. Sir, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for the introduction. A pleasure to be here and just an absolute honor.
Yeah, we love talking to you earlier on our show that we do on the radio show. And so we got to know you, and we just really appreciate you coming back and spending time to tell us a little bit about Christopher Dorner and that investigation. Can you kind of take off where I left off, and please correct anything where I might have been astray?
No, that sounds good, and for sure. And, you know, rest assured, this was probably the largest manhunt, in the Southern California region in decades. So there was hundreds and hundreds of folks that contributed to this terrible time. So February 4th or 5th, you hit it correctly. Lieutenant Randy Kwan was Mr. Dorner's representative at the Board of Rights hearing. And as a result, not as due to his actions, but as a result, the board found him guilty and he was terminated. So fast forward, he writes very long 10-12 page manifesto and launches that to the LA Times somewhere around February 4th, 2013. He enacts his revenge on what he thought was his frustration at the process, and kills his representative's Lieutenant Randy Kwan's daughter and her fiance in the city of Irvine. Just when these notifications were coming to the organization from the city of Irvine, the manifesto started to bubble up, and the LA Times got a hold of it and was given to the organization. And so the following night, I think it was the 5th, I was a captain at LAPD Newton area. So I was a commanding officer of one of the 21 divisions in LA. I was driving home. I remember I got a call from my boss, one of the commanders of Central Bureau. And he said, "Hey, Ed, I need all of your gang units." And it was probably 1800, so 6 p.m. "I need all your gang units to saddle up and get downtown for a briefing." And I said, "Okay, what's this about?" He goes, "Right now, need to know. And you can just trust me that you don't need to know, and we're going to take care of it." And I made my last ditch plea to keep my gang units in Newton Division, because it's one of the five South Central Los Angeles commands. And without 20 gang officers, that would expose some significant violent crime to the command. So the commander understood. He said, "Hey, there's a higher calling. I'll keep you posted." And I said, "Okay, well, I trusted him. I mean, he outranks me." And I called my sergeant and launched the 20 officers and I think two sergeants for this briefing. And I went home, had dinner. And about, I'd say, 2 o'clock in the morning, somewhere in there, I got a phone call from my watch commander. Now, I lived at the time 50 miles east of Los Angeles in the city of Norco and just south of me, the neighboring town in Corona. I get a phone call from my watch commander that says, "Hey, sir, two of our officers at Newton were involved in an officer-involved shooting at the 15 freeway in Ontario." So, you know, mind you, I'm sound asleep. I wake up 15 in Ontario. I said, "What in the heck are they doing 50 miles east of the city, you know, 2 exits from my house?" That was, you know, the biggest concern. So, of course, I was like 2 exits away. Myself and my bureau chief, Jose Perez, was the first one on scene with a Corona Police Department supervisor. And that's when I first found out that they were involved with an officer-involved shooting with Christopher Dorner. So what had happened between those last 8 hours, between 1800 when I sent the officers to the detail and then 02, they had split up the organization in 6, 8, 10-man teams and started up protection details for about 30 folks that were identified in this manifesto that Christopher Dorner was going to enact revenge on. Well, my guys were part of a team that was going to, you know, sit on either a detective or somebody's house in Riverside County. That's why they were there. So of course, as you know, being good cops, they got out to their post about, I'd say, 2300, somewhere in there, and they're stopping at a local AMPM to get, you know, all juiced up for the night, sunflower seeds, beef jerky, monsters. And they walk into an AMPM and they say, "Hey, that, you know, a citizen, you know, thank God," says, "Hey, that dude that's on the news you're looking for, he's out in the parking lot." And they're like, "What?" So they looked up at the news and saw the bulletin and realized, okay, Christopher Dorner, the reason we're here, 2 and 2, holy cow, that's him. They see him. They go running out to the police car. And as luck would have it, you know, of course, they're 50 miles east of the city. So outside radio communication, no repeater, can't talk to anybody on the radios. The mobile data terminals in the car don't work. The microwave signal doesn't go that far. And the two officers lost their cell phones when they ran to the car and they left them in the parking lot of the AMPM. So they start following Christopher Dorner in his pickup truck, northbound 15 freeway, and they're trying to call the plate in. Of course, no response. They're trying to run the plate on the MDT. And of course, that's not going through. So they get off the 15 in Ontario going northbound. And this is a long 270-degree sweeping turn. And they give some space, and probably Christopher Dorner stops at the end of the freeway off-ramp and gets out with an AR-15 and fires 26 or 28 rounds at the police car. The two officers that were involved in the shooting, number one was a very tenured police officer, 3, a field training officer, and his probationary officer, I think he had 1 or 2 weeks on the job at the time, just imagine. One of the rounds from the 223 actually split the barrel of the 870 shotgun that was mounted in between the two officers. The driving officer just bailed, leaned over to the left just to duck down from the windshield, pulled out his Smith 4506 and put several rounds towards the suspect through the windshield. And the probationary officer got out and used the door's cover and returned fire as well. from that point, Christopher Dorner got back in his car. He was spooked. He tried to do a magazine release, and he dropped the full magazine. And he gets in his car, and he takes off along this road. And, of course, my officers are shaken up. The driving officer took a skipped round on the just basic grazing round on his forehead. They're both lucky to be alive.
Wow.
They do a flag down of a passing car, and then they called 911, and that's how, obviously, you know, the notifications went. But the horrifying thing is that once Christopher Dorner was engaged by my officers, he continues on this road for 7 miles, comes to a traffic light, and stops in the city of Riverside.
Yes.
And, of course, he's now involved in an officer-involved shooting. He thinks the whole world knows he's hot. And, of course, at this point, no one knew. There was no ability to get information out yet. And Christopher Dorner, you know, executes a Riverside cop and shoots another one. And so we're at three homicides, another shooting victim, and we're all within 12 hours and two officer-involved shootings. And then from there, the manhunt unfolded. It was, you know, it was six or eight. I think it lasted 9 total days. You know, but I can tell you the information flow, you know, it had the entire region on its heels. And for me, humbly, I spent 27 years as an officer in Los Angeles. This is the first time ever that as an organization, for me, we were on the defense. We were on our heels.
I cannot thank you enough for kind of filling in the beginning part of that manhunt, that 9 days. Our next guests are going to kind of take that baton and talk about as it went into the Big Bear area. Again, thank you so much, Commander, and enjoy.
Yeah, crazy times for sure.
Enjoy your well-deserved retirement. So this is a perfect place really to paint a picture for our next guest, who was he's a pilot, he's a reserve deputy, and he's an emergency room physician. I mean, my God, talk about a title, right? Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's a show in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But the lead in to paint a picture for him. So at this point, when that shooting occurred, and now Christopher Dorner has killed three people, as the commander spoke about, he then loses control of his vehicle. He doesn't know how to drive in the snow. He crashes into a snowbank. He flees in the area, which is the Big Bear Lake community. And by dumb luck, he finds a condo that's unlocked because it's under renovations. And so the owners leave it unlocked so that workers can come and go. And he locks it. And so now when the command post is set up, they're looking. They have a 3-mile radius perimeter on this crime scene looking for this killer of three people. They don't find him because they checked locked doors. If there's no forced entry, they move to the next door. So he's able to hide out for 5 days, 100 feet from the command post. Insane, right?
True. The irony in that is
insane. So from February 7th to February 12th. Now, February 12th, they're dismantling the command post. They're moving on thinking he's dead or he's out of the area. And that's when the owners of the condo return home. Karen Reynolds and her husband come home. They're going to pick up a mattress or something. They end up being confronted by this monster. And he puts a pillowcase over their heads. He puts something over their mouth so they can't talk. He zip ties their hands behind their backs, and then he takes off with their car. He carjacks them. This Karen, she does an amazing job. She's able to take her pillowcase off her head, able to take the stuff out of her mouth without hands. She then uses her looks around, finds her phone, and calls 911 from behind her back. And that gets Fish and Game into the action. Okay. They find him. He's still in the Big Bear Lake area. He crashes that vehicle, the carjacked Reynolds vehicle. And now a gunfight ensues, and multiple officers are being shot at. Christopher Dorner has a huge supply of ammunition. He has an AR-15. He has a suppressor. They don't know where the shots are coming from. And sadly, horrifically, Detective Jeremiah McKay is shot and killed, and another officer, Alex Collins, is horrifically wounded, and we have a hero in the air, and that hero is our next guest. We have Dr. Michael Gerges. He is, again, a flight physician. He is a law enforcement flight physician, pilot, emergency medicine doctor. He does it all. And you were in the air. And I could talk an hour about who you are, sir. But for the purpose of the show, I kind of want to get into, why were you in the air, and were you in route to this location, or was it happenstance?
Hey, how you guys doing? Well, thank you for, you know, having me on, and it's nice to meet you guys. So, you know, as you said, I was a physician in the air. So actually at the time, so I worked for San Bernardino County Sheriff's Air Rescue Team. And that happened to be my day that I was working that day as a shift. So we happened to get to the airport, and we were told, hey, listen, the Riverside PD wants to have us flown up from Rialto, which where we were hangared, out to Big Bear, because they wanted to investigate the vehicle that was stolen out of Riverside after, you know, I'll call him the monster. I don't really refer to his name. Had shot their Riverside officer. So we actually flew them up, landed at Big Bear Airport, decided to just kind of wait for them, get lunch, actually breakfast at that time. So we'd gone breakfast. And then we realized that they were going to be delayed. So we were just going to go ahead and lift off and go back to Rialto. And when they were ready, we'd come back and get them. So we did that. We had breakfast, saw some of the locals. They were asking, you know, hey, have you guys caught him? Are we going to catch him? And we were just like, you know, he's probably long gone by now, which were words we would soon eat. And we ended up going back to the airport, and we took off. And then we started to hear radio chatter of possible carjacking, possible suspect being still up there, and we were the first helicopter in the air. And you know, we're in a UH-1 Huey, we're a medical air rescue ship, we're not a patrol ship, and so we basically became the patrol ship at that time. So we were helping with the search, helping with the chase. He had carjacked that family's vehicle and was driving around, and it was fish and game that was in pursuit. And at that point, they lost him. They had found the vehicle, but actually lost him. And that's kind of when, you know, the command post and all the sheriff deputies, along with Fish and Game, were starting, you know, to look for him. We were still up in the air. Patrol ship, you know, comes. And that's the point where we heard, you know, officer down. So they had basically, Alex and Jeremiah were first, and they were out there looking. And that's when both Jeremiah and Alex got hit. And then obviously everybody went to that area where they were down. And that's basically kind of where we, as the air rescue medical crew, came in.
When you hear that 999, and that's the radio code we know as Phoenix cops, Jason and I, officer down. When you heard that, what was going through your mind? I can't help but think that as skilled as you are, but you're an emergency room tech doctor, were you able to stay calm? Can you talk about your emotions hearing that officer down?
Yeah, I mean, like anything, officer down, it's one of your brothers, right? I'm a reserve deputy. I work 2 days a month on the rescue ship, but they're still brothers to me. So obviously, you know, someone's going to be shot, and more likely than not, they're going to have massive wounds because of, we already knew the caliber weapon he was using. And so you have to kind of be prepared for that. And we're in the snow, we're in the mountains, and, you know, medical up there on the ground is going to be limited. And our trauma center is an hour by ground, but maybe 15 minutes by air. So we knew we were going to have to get involved, but yeah, I mean, your heart sinks and you know, you get into medical mode. I mean, I've been doing it for 19 years at that time. It's been 10 years now. I was doing it for 9 or 10 years. So I was pretty confident in my skills of being able to, you know, help someone out and get them to the trauma center, but you just kind of go into medical mode and you just block everything else out of your mind.
Talk about, or paint a picture if you would, in regards to that landing and the minutes and hours that preceded.
So we actually found an LZ. We were flying. We were near the house where the gunfire was going on. We landed. We usually do not fly with armor, I would say. We're usually a medical. And we landed. We met one of the fishing game officers, and he actually had some some armor for us to wear, some vests. And we ended up being, I believe, to the east of Glass Road, east of where the house was that he was hunkered down in. And, you know, Alex and Jeremiah were down, and there was no way for us to get there unless we basically cut through the line of fire. So at that point, we had heard that two other deputies who were on the SWAT team, who later found out was Danny Rosa and Larry Lopez, had grabbed Jeremiah, had grabbed Alex, had put them in their unmarked truck, and actually had driven them out of there to get them going, providing, you know, medical as they were getting out of there. So at that point, we had ended up heading back to our rescue ship, taking off, and then met them basically on a ice road down the street as they just kind of got out where, you know, the hot zone was.
At this point, you're a doctor, you're treating this, like you said, as an AR-15, you know, this a very serious round. Talk about what you saw in terms of Alex, if you can, in terms of his injuries, because in everything I've read, you saved his life.
So yeah, I, you know, listen, we do what we do. I did what I was trained to do. I mean, if that's saving a life or just kind of helping him get out of that situation, it is what it is. It's just kind of what we do. And I was there with another medic that was on the ship with us, another EMT. And then we had our pilot and our full-timer, sergeant at the time that was giving us cover. So he had been transported in a vehicle, that truck. We were able to get Jeremiah out, who at that point had succumbed to his injuries. And Alex was there, and Alex was badly hurt. I mean, he had taken, and this is common knowledge, and people have talked about this, he had taken a round to his jaw and face. He had taken a round to his arm, to his leg. I believe he had even taken one to his chest, and the vest had stopped it. And his biggest issue, obviously, was pain, but also was going to be his airway. I mean, he had a massive facial injury.
And you're able to do what you did. We caught triage. Can you talk about that triage effect and getting him ready? And how was he airlifted? Did you guys do it in your helicopter? Or was there another helicopter that was flown in for that purpose?
No, so we did it in our helicopter. So we fly a Vietnam era UH-1 Huey, which is basically meant for medical transport. That's what we do, our transports, our rescues, our hoist. And like I said, it was just dumb luck that we just happened to be up in Big Bear when all this happened. So we, you know, obviously we landed, we had got Alex over to our rescue ship. You know, I couldn't put him, like we transport most people, I couldn't put him on his back and supine. He would have aspirated. He had so many facial wounds, so much blood. So we actually had to transport him kind of on his side to the point where I could get on the ground of the helicopter and just kind of get face to face with him. Just kind of, just basically hold his jaw in place and together. I mean, that's how bad the wound is. So, you know, I don't want to say too much, but I mean, that's basically
understood
what happened. So, you know, basically trying to talk to him and keep him calm. And you got to remember at the time he had just had a 3-week old.
Wow.
He was on paternity leave, but his two brothers were up there who had worked on SWAT team. So he's got two older brothers and he decided to go up there and help with the manhunt while on paternity leave. So,
wow.
You know, that was a conversation me and Alex had, you know, during that that transport,
that flight. I want to bring in Jason Sheckley. I see some parallels in terms of what happened to you, Jason, in terms of having the fire department right there when your patrol car caught in fire. And I can't help but think that Alex has this very special relationship with the doctor. Your thoughts?
I can only imagine. I want to go back real quick, Doc, if you don't mind, just because, you know, as a public speaker and as somebody who's gone through a critical incident, I know that what people love, what our audience loves, and truly what they need is they need to feel like they were there. They need to understand. So a two-part question. And again, I know you said that you don't want to say too much, but when you're dealing with a guy, you're both a flight medic as well as an emergency medicine physician. So you know what you need to do on the ground, on the helicopter, but you also know what's going to happen once you get him to the hospital. So when you talk about the facial injuries and the airway that could be compromised, the fact that you can't lay him supine, you know, are you doing simple things like making sure he can talk? Are you watching his breathing, or did you go ahead and, or did you have to trach him while he was sitting up? I'm trying to understand what kind of needs were before you get to the hospital.
Yeah, so, you know, I trained at Loma Linda. So we took Alex to Loma Linda University Medical Center, which is a level one trauma center. So I had trained there and I'd finished my training, I don't know, six years prior to that. So I knew I was taking him, you know, to a familiar place where I knew the trauma surgeons and everyone. So when we did get there, no, there was no trach. Being able to roll him kind of on his side where I could get down at his level, talk to him and make sure he continued to talk to me, and to make sure that I could kind of stop the bleeding that was occurring kind of in his face and just kind of holding his airway open. We didn't have to intubate, nor did we have to do a trach. Okay. If we did, that would have been really difficult to do in the field. So, you know, I've done a lot of, you know, so I am an emergency room physician. I do that basically full time. And, you know, I work with Sheriff Air Rescue as a flight medic slash obviously physician. So I'm able to use my physician skill set on the rescue helicopter. So, you know, there was other things that were being done. I mean, we had a medic and an EMT in the back. And, you know, they were placing IVs and tourniquets and stabilizing. His leg had been pretty much shattered. His forearm had been shattered. And my thing was just kind of keeping his airway important. I mean, if you go into, you know, the trauma protocol, it's always massive hemorrhage first, which we had controlled with pressure and tourniquet, and then get into airway. And yeah, if you can't protect the airway, then everything else goes downhill. So as I was kind of protecting the airway, the two guys that were helping were, and I don't want to use their names because I haven't talked to them prior to this, were helping, and they were, you know, handling business in the back. And I mean, like I said, this, like when you come into a trauma, into the emergency room, it's not one doc. You've got a trauma team and teams yeah. of nurses and an ER doc that's in with the trauma team, and everybody's kind of gotten their role. So that's kind of what we were doing in terms of, you know, getting Alex all set up.
And because of your role at Loma Linda, because that's where you took Alex, were you, you know, in my situation, the firefighters, the paramedics who did just amazing jobs getting me in airway, getting IVs in places that weren't burned. But once they dropped me off, they unfortunately just had to leave knowing they're going to get a call within minutes or maybe an hour that I had passed away, and maybe that their work was, I mean, you know how it affects us. It's devastating. So I don't really need to go into that. But so when you got there, because of your role, did you get off the ship and go in and continue the work, or did you have to go back, get on the ship and hope for the best? And then with that, all these years later, have you talked to Alex at all? And do you still see him today?
Yeah. So we dropped off Alex. We had dropped off Jeremiah. You know, Jeremiah had already passed. Yes. And, you know, we dropped off Jeremiah. And I knew there was the surgeons that I've worked with in the past and the ER docs I've worked with the past. I mean, he was in good hands. So that I wasn't worried about. But basically the reality was, is he still had, you know, an active shooter situation or, you know, someone who was still ready to kill. And, you know, we decided as a team that we weren't, I mean, our mission wasn't over. So we basically made sure everything was good at the hospital, and we got back up on our, you know, our Huey, and we headed back up to Big Bear, and we stayed there pretty late into the night until we kind of knew 100% he was dead and done. And we were able to head back, you know, to our hangar in Rialto and, you know, debrief.
You know, when you say debrief, there's a lot that goes into that, especially in this situation where you have an ex-cop killer, and who literally had that Southern California and paralyzed in fear. This was a scary time. I can't even imagine what you've gone through, let alone what Alex has gone through. Can you kind of talk about the dust settling in 10 years, how you're doing, how you feel, and also your relationship with Alex and where he's at in his career, if that's okay?
Yeah, sure. So I've kept in contact with Alex. I just had children 4 and 5 years ago. So he actually came to my daughter's 1 year birthday, which was 4 years ago. Aww. So, I mean, I've been in contact with him. He and his wife, Lila, have come, and they came with his son, who at the time, you know, is almost 10 now. So I don't know, he was 5 or 6. So they come to a birthday party. I just had lunch with Alex, I don't know, maybe a month ago. But we've always kind of kept in contact. Like most things, life is just busy. We're not in as much contact as I'd like to be, but he's busy. He's doing well. He's promoted. He's still continuing to do police work. I mean, the guy is a stud. He gets invited every year to talk to each academy class about the will to survive. I mean, obviously he's got the will to survive. I mean, the whole time, you know, I know he's talked about this in interviews before, but he was just kind of worried about, you know, leaving his son without a father. A lot of what I did, I would say, wasn't medicine. A lot of what I did was just letting him know that everything was going to be okay, to hold on. We were going to get him, you know, more help, and he would be fine. Really good dude. He was going to make it. He did have that will. He did have a lot of injuries that, you know, maybe someone else who didn't have that will to survive, or didn't have that child to live for, or that family to live for, maybe wouldn't have. And, you know, he was lucky, his wound pattern, and just kind of having that will that he has, he made it through, and he's striving. He's doing well now. He looks good.
I love that. I love the idea that there's a shining light at the end of this horrific story. As far as the community, can you kind of talk about the community, what it was like at that time? I keep talking about how they're, you know, paralyzed in fear. Is that just, you know, hyperbole, or was that really what was like during that time? And what kind of takeaway has the community given you in terms of support of law enforcement?
Yeah, I mean, things have changed, you know, these days in terms of support of law enforcement. But back then, yeah, there was a lot of support. I'd hate to even think about if this were to happen today, the way politics are and the way, you know, law enforcement is treated in the media. But there was a lot of support. I remember even going up to Big Bear that day when we bought breakfast. Someone wanted to buy breakfast for us. They knew that we were up there looking for him. But yeah, I mean, law enforcement is, there's a special kind of person that likes to do law enforcement, someone that wants to go out and help. And it's still to that day. I think you even have to have a stronger desire to help, especially in this, like I said, political climate where law enforcement is villainized. But yeah, no, I mean, we did get a lot of support. I don't know if we were in fear or paralyzed. I mean, I think that's probably just media, you know, just nonsense that they like to portray. But I mean, but there was some, you know, concern, and it was very disturbing that he was out, you know, trying to kill police officers actively, and he was well trained.
Yeah, I cannot thank you enough for being on the show and talking to us about something that probably has to be very difficult to talk about. And also want, please relay our love to your brother, Alex, and he's always welcome on Badge Boys. Cannot thank you enough, doctor, for being there, for what you do, and for being a stud. My God, a physician, a pilot, and a deputy. You're the best.
Thanks, sir.
All right. I appreciate it. I'll relay the message. I'll be talking to Alex pretty soon, and yeah, we'll see. Maybe we can get him on, and you know, he can talk to, you know, others that are in the field of law enforcement about that will to survive, and maybe tell his story on you know, out of his words.
Well, I could tell you it matters, especially right now with the pendulum being a little bit low. A lot of these new officers, they need to hear about the will to survive. They need to understand what it's like to be a 5 percenter, and you know, it's going to happen to some of us. So I think that's very important. If Alex wants to share that story, we can give him a great platform, and I would certainly love to meet him. But thank you very much, Doc. I really, you really got me in the heart today, and I appreciate you.
I appreciate it, guys. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, that wraps it up for this interview regarding the manhunt on a cop killer. We'll be right back.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this. If you like the Badge Boys, you'll love their books, starting with Burning Shield, the Jason Schechterle story, which Arizona Diamondbacks president Derek Hall proclaimed, "Jason is an inspiration, and his story must be read and shared." The professionally written novel is a powerful biography chronicling Jason's gut-wrenching battle to health after being trapped in a fireball that consumed his police car, and his high-stakes legal showdown against the Ford Motor Company for their explodingly lethal Crown Victoria police cruisers. Then there's Darren's award-winning Twisted But True book trilogy, with close to 100 compelling and funny true crime stories that American detectives with Lieutenant Joe Kenda producer called the perfect blend of humor, heroism, and honor. And retired Colonel Dave Grossman declared, "Darren's Twisted But True books are hilarious, deep, and powerful." Each book in the series received the Pinnacle Award for the best true crime book, and a story from book two was featured on an ID Channel television show. And Robin's most recent book, Soul Stirrings, reviewed as an often humorous and spiritually uplifting story of a widow's soul-searching pilgrimage to the afterlife. Darren called it a love story, a ghost story, an investigative story. It's a story like no other. And Robin's first book, Victim No More, where she shares her harrowing experiences with rape and domestic violence as Robin takes the reader on a very personal journey through the morass of abuse and loss, and ultimately, survival. These Badge Boy books should be on everybody's top 10 reading list.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterle. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to Badge Boys, everybody. Darren has, we've had a lot of great shows, and we're having our 200th, been doing this for 4 years. There are not a lot that I can relate to. There's not a lot that hit me in the heart. Having Dr. Gerges on, you can hear in his voice the pain of the memories. But, you know, there's some people that they want the ball, they want to do their job, and they do it humbly. They do it just because that's what they choose to do. And, you know, I know all these years later, I still, I inundate the firefighters on my call with questions. I still learn things, and I still want them to, and I recognize how it changed their lives, what they saw, what they went through. And to have Dr. Gerges talking about this 10 years later, it's an appalling set of events. It's an appalling 9 days. I don't want to say it had a good end, because people died.
Yeah.
You know,
he murdered four people.
Then you do have the people like Alex. You do have the people like Dr. Gerges and the rest of his crew that hopefully have gone on to just become better because of that. Because, you know, we don't get to hear, well, what did you do next? What was your next call? What was your fifth call after that? What was your call 5 years later? I mean, he saved a bunch more lives that we don't get to hear about. We get to hear about Alex, and then we get to hear the transport of the deputy that succumbed. And I don't know, that just really hit me in the heart. I'm so glad you got him on, and I deeply appreciate him, and it makes me want to call my doctors and my my firefighters and the people who saved my life and just simply say, hey, I just want to remind you, thank you for what you did. So
yeah, when he shared his story initially, when I was, you know, looking for shows and so forth, especially for our 200th show for our podcast, I wanted something very special, and this one sang to me because of the connection that you have, quite frankly. This was the odds of this helicopter being up in the air and being an air rescue and having a pilot doctor. Now, he's a pilot, but there was someone else flying, which was perfect, because then he could deal with the trauma as a doctor. It made me think of you and the fire truck. It really did. I mean,
timing's everything.
Yeah.
I mean, and you can't, you know what? It's okay to not be able to even explain it.
Yeah.
I don't mind when people talk about miracles or twists of fate or God, you know, putting you in the right. None of that matters. What matters is they were there and they were able to do their job.
And then there's the other factor. Alex has a heart of a champion, as a survivor, just like you, my
man,
friend.
Man, I want to meet this guy so bad. I'm gonna do everything to try and find him. You're probably better than I am, but I want to get in touch. Even if he doesn't want to come on the show,
well,
I would love to get in touch with him because his story needs to be shared because it's going to save other people's lives. And sometimes we don't realize that. And, you know, I think in some, we're called to serve, right? Dr. Gerges is called to serve. Alex was called to serve. You and I were called to serve. I think in some ways we now, when you go through something like this, you do have a duty to pass that on to the next generation because some of them are going to go through it. So I would love to speak to the guy.
And to that end, I'm not going to lie to you. That wasn't the first time me and the doctor were talking about Alex. Actually, when I first contacted him, I said, I'd love to get Alex on the show. Oh, is that possible? And he said, you know, let me talk to him. He hasn't done it.
He might not.
We get it. We totally get it. But we're not a regular media organization. We're the badge boys.
Exactly.
We're cops.
It's a lot different.
So if I were to put money on it, I'd be putting money on it.
You know what? I trust you. So
right,
let's do it. All right. So we're going to.
I got some headlines.
Of course you do.
And they're actually good ones because this was such a good show.
Yeah, let's not ruin it.
Thank you. Thank you, my friend. The first headline, and I kind of talked to you, and almost I never, ever tell you headlines, but because this was near and dear to your heart, and I love you, so it was near and dear to my heart, a Oklahoma City firefighter saves a dog from a frozen lake. Did you hear this story?
I did.
what'd you think?
Well, I love it because, first of all, I love dogs, but this goes to show you that people in uniform do not differentiate. It does not matter about
life is a life.
Life is a life. And for all the things that we're hearing right now on CNN or other media or from the hordes of incredibly disgusting politicians across the country, it's not true. A life is a life. It doesn't matter, you know, race, color, gender, how much money you have in the bank. None
species.
Of that matters. But yes, to that point, it doesn't matter the species. You are wearing a uniform and you get a call and you do what you do to save a life. And I mean, this cop, there was a lot of disregard for his own life. You know, that's easy to take for granted.
Oh, yeah.
It'd be very easy to
freezing water.
Be like, that's a dog. I mean, I'm not going home to my spouse and kids because of a dog. You don't think like that when you're a first responder. Just simply don't. You go out and do the job, and it's pretty cool. And I promise you, he made a family very, very special
happy. Christmas.
Oh, a very special Christmas because you don't want to lose your dog. Trust me, you do not want to lose your dog.
The other headline I picked up, again, with you in mind, my friend, is I'm not a college football guy. You are.
Yes,
you are.
Oh, man. I absolutely live and die for college football.
The headline is former Nebraska quarterback Tommy Armstrong Jr. saves his neighbors from a house fire. As we're saying this, we have the sirens in the background of a fire rolling to another.
Yeah, I'm not removing
life.
That.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Robin.
Production value.
Timing.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Have you heard this headline?
Actually, I have not. I do know who Tommy Armstrong Jr. is.
Okay.
He was an outstanding player. But again, this just takes you know, all these years later to, you don't know when you're going to be put into a situation, when you're going to be thrust into a scene that, fight or flight is real. Looking at something and it being surreal, thinking, am I really seeing what I'm seeing?
Yeah, been there.
And then you have all kinds of options that come natural. Well, I got to call 911. Well, is the fire, you know, you're saying this is a neighbor. Is it going to go to the next house? Is it going to come to my house? What do I need to get out? Do I have family and daughter? You're going through all these things and you're doing it in milliseconds. For him to just see it and rush over there and save his neighbors is a beautiful thing because, again, I'm not ever going to disrespect fight or flight syndrome in people. You just don't know
until you're there.
Yeah. And for him to do what he did and to save lives He didn't need a uniform on. He didn't need anything. And it's just a beautiful story of humanity. It's a beautiful story of courage and kindness, and lives were saved. You know, so that's kind of all that matters. I love it. I love
it. Yeah. He goes over, and again, quarterback, right? So he throws a ball. Well, he threw the brick. Yeah. He threw a brick through the window, was able to access inside the house. So he quarterbacked the hell out of that.
Yes, he did.
The last headline, it sounds like it's, in fact, it is a sad headline in and of itself, but I want to kind of go to the bigger picture. 30 dead in Western New York after a historic blizzard. And 8 were arrested for looting in stores in Buffalo while this was going on. My takeaway, and I want you to kind of opine on this, is while this is happening, we both were cops. We both did 508. We both did traffic control and these accidents and bad weather, inclement weather. But I've never been in a blizzard. I can't imagine these officers, men and women, working in blizzard conditions, trying to keep things safe and going to these accidents and so forth. What do you think, my friend?
You know, this is just this is a one of a kind. They get obviously the Northeast, New England, and then places in the, you know, like Minnesota, Michigan. I lived in North Dakota for 2 years. I mean, you face your harsh winters, but this is a once in a generation, or maybe once in 100 year. They're calling it, you know, a winter cyclone,
storm of
Central. And I read this morning, the death toll's risen to, I think, 34. First Aww. Responders right now, Darren, are faced with the simple, scary task of just going door to door looking for bodies of people who might not have survived. I can't fathom 34 people dead in a snowstorm. I saw another story where 30 people were trapped in a Target when the blizzard hit because they couldn't get out. So the magnitude of this is unbelievable. I mean, erase Christmas, erase going to work, erase the day-to-day things that these people were thinking about just 10 days ago, and now 34 of them are dead, and the first responders are out there having to work their butts off. Now, when you move to the other side of it, and I know this is not the politically correct thing to say, and I don't really care. When you are dealing with natural disasters like this, when you have the hurricanes down in the Gulf or the Atlantic, when you have these snowstorms, when you
earthquakes.
When you have earthquakes, we have gotten to a point, maybe it's my age, maybe it's my former career and the fact that I haven't been a cop in 16 years, but if you are looting in these situations, it is my firm belief, and if I was king of the world, I'm telling you, deadly force should be authorized, and I wish every first responder would just open fire and kill these looters on site. And I really don't give a fuck what a politician or a media person has to say about that, because if you're stealing, listen, if you run into a Walmart and you steal a VCR, I don't want to hear bullshit of, I can't believe I just said VCR. How old am I? God dang.
The clock is blinking.
But no, this I'm going all the way back to like Hurricane Katrina and watching what looters did.
Yeah.
If you are going and stealing in those situations, instead of helping your fellow man, you know what? Deadly force should be authorized. And again, I don't really care if that's not politically correct. Kill them all.
To your point, political purposes, the mayor of Buffalo, where this occurred, a Democrat, and I don't care whether you're Republican or Democrat, he came out and said, if you do this, you are the low of the low. You are scum. Well, I like what he said.
But what do their words matter? It doesn't prevent it. It doesn't matter. But just is being politically expedient. Like, well, I stuck up for the – fuck that mayor.
I like the fact – okay, we're going to disagree, my friend.
Good.
I love the idea that
I'm getting pissed off.
I love the idea that he said this. He said, while officers are going to arrest you, they could be going neighbor to neighbor to neighbor to neighbor. He made great, solid points.
Good.
And I don't care about whether he's red, blue,
no, independent, it doesn't matter.
Green.
He did.
He made the point. If there wasn't just a microphone, he'd be using the language you're using, brother.
You know what? That's probably true. If he could use the language I was using, but I do love the rhetoric for a change. But I'd also like to know, what is he doing to assist first responders in making not those words making those forward, words come true
moving forward
that we're going to move in that direction. So it's just a horrible situation, and you know, God bless everybody that's going through it. I'm sitting here, and I mean, it's raining in Phoenix today, and it's 55, and I'm acting like the world is coming to an end. You know, like,
but we're not used to rain, brother. Well, we're not used to rain. To our defense,
or 55 degrees. Like you. I walked outside of my house this morning, and I'm freezing to death. How absurdly selfish is that? But I don't live in Buffalo. I don't live in some of these places and what they're going through. I mean, I just really, my prayers and my thoughts are with all of them.
Wish them well. Yeah.
But I do love how fired up you get, Jason.
No, this kind of stuff, Robin, when it comes to looting, when it comes to, instead of helping somebody else and making the day better, you're consciously and actively making it worse. I'm just tired of it. And the only way that we're ever going to get this current low point of the pendulum to swing is to get to places like Singapore, where, you know what, if you spit gum out on the sidewalk, we're going to cane your ass like 17 times and you're going to have permanent scars. If we had that, you know what they don't have over there? Crime. Do you know why? Because they don't allow it. And we encourage it right now. And it just drives me crazy.
If everyone out there would channel their inner Dr. G, who became a pilot, became a deputy, became an ER doctor, this world would be such a better place.
It would be a much better place, yes.
And on that note, we'll be right back with a heroic headline, stupid suspect story, and Jason's always inspirational closing message. We'll be right back.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
During these challenging days, we not only need to remember our many fallen heroes for their ultimate sacrifice, but also honor them so their families know we've not forgotten. And that's what the Arizona Fallen Hero Memorial Riders Organization is all about. Each year, the nonprofit organizes three memorial rides among the beautiful backdrop of North, South, and Central Arizona, with the proceeds going to the 100 Club of Arizona. Learn more about these fun rides and how you can honor all of Arizona's fallen heroes at ArizonaFallenHeroesMemorialRiders.org.
You're listening to Batch Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Batch Boys.
Welcome back, everyone. I just cannot get over the heroic actions of Dr. G and the incredible inspirational survival, the will survive by Alex. They're my two new heroes. And speaking of heroes, who better to read the heroic headline than my hero, Jason?
Well, this week's heroic headline is definitely heroic because it saved a life. I'm not into comparison. Obviously, the story we heard earlier is pretty amazing, and you don't hear those stories often. But I want to highlight a story that is happening every day. We've talked about this countless times on this show. The opioid pandemic, the genocide, the murder that's going on, and being the leading cause of death. So anytime I see a life saved by a first responder, I definitely want to highlight it. And recently released footage shows responders administering Narcan to a drug-impaired driver after he had veered off an interstate in Youngstown, Ohio, according to the Ohio State Patrol. And video captured by the Ohio State Patrol on dash cam and body cameras shows that the vehicle was drastically drifting between lanes, briefly off-roading before coming to a stop. Officers ran up to the car, found an unresponsive driver slumped over the steering wheel, recognized it for, you know, didn't just take for granted, oh, this person's drunk, this person fell asleep. No, they recognized it. They were trained well. They'd seen it before. And Ohio, unfortunately, is getting hit harder than most states when it comes to this opioid crisis. They immediately administered Narcan to this driver. The Ohio State Patrol said that troopers have made more than 71,000 stops of people operating vehicles impaired. They've made over 71,000 arrests, and nearly a fourth of those have involved people impaired by drugs. The video on the OSHP dash cam shows the car nearly crashed into the semi truck. Thankfully, it did not, because the driver might not have had a chance to be saved. But they administered Narcan. The driver, of course, if you've ever seen it,
I saw that video.
It is one of the both scariest, breathtaking, and amazing things you will ever witness, because somebody somebody goes from
dead. Well,
we talked about the female officer just last week.
Yeah.
She, on video, this girl was gray and dead. And a couple shots of Narcan, and boom. I mean, they sit up. Sometimes they want to fight. Sometimes they're, but it's the first time I ever saw it, and this is going back 20 years before it was like in
common
vogue.
Now.
Yeah, yeah.
Sadly,
I was
common.
Like, and you know, that was also back when they just jammed a needle in the heart, which is also
the nose is so much nicer.
Yeah, yeah. The nasal spray is a whole lot less barbaric.
It's not Pulp Fiction time.
But when you see what Narcan can do, it's all those things I described. It's like, whoa.
Yeah.
And people wake up and they come back to life. So, you know, and I hope one of these days, I hope Narcan is in all of our pockets. Kind of like, you know, how people carry pepper spray. You know, I still carry a knife and a gun everywhere I go because I live in Phoenix. But Narcan should be in all of our pockets because it is such a problem. So
sadly,
the Ohio State Patrol, great job for recognizing what it is, and your training, you're going off of your past experiences, and you saved a life. Yeah.
And speaking of saving a life, the doctor wants to jump in and say something, guys.
Oh, outstanding. Hey,
Dr. G,
yes,
welcome
Dr.
back.
G.
Yeah, Jason, so I was just listening in. So yeah, so Narcan is a lifesaver with this fentanyl epidemic, and even street drugs, cocaine and other things are being cut with fentanyl. So you think you're getting your regular strength, you know, Percocet street pill or Vicodin street pill, and they're cutting it with fentanyl. So your two doses that get you high ends up killing you because you OD. It's very sad, but I'm going to say it. I just acquired 150 doses for my child's school. They're 4 and 5.
Nice.
Wow, good for you.
Yeah. So for their high school, which is another campus, and then the kindergarten through eighth grade, another campus, I was able to acquire 150 doses and pass it out to every teacher or staff that did the training, just in case. Heaven forbid they ever have to use it and it expires in 3 years and we have to throw it in the trash. But if that's the case, then, you know, they have it.
Well, Dr. G, I want you to expand real quick so that people truly understand, because right now it's the leading cause of death in people 18 to 45. I've equated it to, imagine if an airplane, a commercial airliner, crashed every day in the United States. You know, the politicians and the media would do something, but they're not doing anything about this. But as an emergency room physician, if somebody overdoses on fentanyl and we simply take them to the hospital, by the time we get to you, it's way too late. So explain the value of Narcan and just how quick that works and why it is necessary to be in places. It floors me that you're telling me you got it into an elementary school. That is amazing, but it's also scary to know that that's where we need it. But I'd love for you to expand on the importance of how it's needed, because you're not going to be able to help by the time they get to you.
Yeah. So Narcan is the brand name of the actual naloxone that we've been using for tens of years. Medics would have it. It was an IV dose. You gave it intramuscular or intravenous. Well, now they've made it basically intranasal. So the same medication you can push through the nose gets in the bloodstream that way. Now they've made it so anybody can give it. So that's what Narcan is. Basically what it does is it gets into the bloodstream. The receptors in your brain that take up the opiate class medications like fentanyl, Vicodin, dilaudid, morphine, all those are in the same class. So this works for all those medications. Those medications, if you get too much in your brain, basically decrease your heart rate, decrease your respiratory drive to breathe. And so that's the OD, is you get so sedate that you just basically, you no longer want to breathe. And so that's what the Narcan does, is it basically gets into your bloodstream, kicks off the opiates off the opiate receptors in your brain, bind them, and have no effect on those opiate receptors. And that's why you wake up within, you know, 15, 30 seconds to a minute. And that's it. I mean, you literally save the life. It's the same thing we could talk about AEDs. Yeah. You can do CPR for 5, 10, 15 minutes so you get to the ER and let them shock. Or we can just make it dummy-proof, make it very simple. Anybody can do it. You open it up. It tells you step-by-step what to do, and you can save a life. So, you know, it's just now technology is getting put out into the field, and we can use it. So we have it. We need to use it.
That's so good.
Yeah. I got a follow-up question. We're going to just keep using you, Dr. G. God, you're awesome.
Skip the other two segments.
As technology advances, like you said, and now AEDs are getting smaller and smaller. I remember as a cop, they're huge, and they were just not practical to be in vehicles and all that. And now, my God, they're a size very small and getting smaller and cheaper. Is that what's happening with this? I hate to think of pharmaceutical industry getting rich off this horrific situation we have with fentanyl, but is that Narcan getting cheaper? And do you foresee a time, depending on the price, that people are going to have it? Because sadly, it's our reality now.
Yeah, I mean, the Narcan's expensive. I mean, I think a two-dose pack is $140 for two doses. It's expensive, you know, and it expires in 2 to 3 years. I don't know. The pharmaceuticals, they're going to make money where they need to. It's a very inexpensive medication when it's given it IV. But because this is a new modality and the way they can give it, that's basically easy intranasal with all the testing. I mean, it is what it is. The reality is there's an opioid overdose epidemic. And, you know, we just had a young girl die in an LA County school in a bathroom. She was found like a day later. I don't know if Narcan would have helped her because nobody found her, but I mean, kids are dying, you know, people who don't use drugs, who are unsuspectedly taking something that looks like a candy, which is a fentanyl that is made to look like candy so that they can, you know, murder, transport it across the country. Murder. I mean, it's insane. So law enforcement, obviously fire personnel, you know, I work in the executive protection industry. Our guys will carry it. You know, anybody who works with anybody that may possibly OD, you know, accidentally or on purpose should have that medication at hand.
Love it. Thank you so much for, you know, filling us in and educating us on Narcan. And, you know, what I knew was from Pulp Fiction. So I know very little. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you, doctor.
You're welcome.
You know, you take us to heroism, my friend, with the Dr. G and you talking about this. And of course, I take us to the bowels of humanity with our stupid suspect stories. You know, I have a very special, almost post-Christmas, stupid suspect story. Two retired women were arrested and convicted over feeding stray cats. That's right. In Wetumpka, Alabama, two women were charged with misdemeanors for refusing to obey police and stop feeding the stray cat population. Beverly Roberts, 85, and Mary Olson, 61, were both sentenced to 2 years of unsupervised probation and 10 days in jail. The verdict came after a 5.5-hour trial. The women were known to local officials for feeding and trapping stray cats in the city. Police told Alston to leave the site, saying the city didn't want her feeding cats. Both women noted that feeding the cats on public property was not illegal, but their disagreement with police escalated to disorderly conduct and screaming and yelling, and they were trespassed, and they refused. During proceedings, attorneys representing the women argued that trespassing charges were invalid because feeding stray cats isn't against the law in Wetumpka. The defense attorneys portrayed the women as animal lovers who were reaching into their own pockets to neuter the cats and have them adopted to return to the area. The city police chief argued that the women were creating a nuisance by feeding the cats, saying, "When you feed cats, more cats come." If they had just simply listened, they would not have been arrested. The officer who testified said that he had no intentions of arresting women. He said the women gave him no choice after they refused to leave. Had they stopped feeding the cats, they would be free. And that is our Christmas cat stupid suspect story. I love that song.
I kind of like that better than the other one, but I'll do the
yeah.
Oh my Lord.
What, Jason?
Well, at least you didn't pick on Florida this week.
That's right.
That makes me happy. You know, I think this week's inspirational close speaks for itself, and we'll just keep it short. Dr. G, just listening to him
wow.
is inspiration. Alex And for what he's done, he's still a father, he's still a husband, and
they still
keep in touch. You hear these stories that just make you want to keep going. But I want to point out, Darren, I recently read the DOJ report, you know, because everything you've been hearing about law enforcement the last few years, you talk about 2020 all the time, I have brought up that the devastation that has occurred in 2.5 years is going to take decades to recover from. But the DOJ, which I have zero faith in anymore, they're disgusting. Merrick Garland is just a bitter old man. He didn't get his chance on the Supreme Court, so now he's just going to be a dick. And that's fine. But they did release a report that I think is very accurate. And last year there were 54 million police contacts.
Yeah.
Of that 54 million, 2% were of a violent nature. So everybody in law enforcement, everybody, all the firefighters, all the first responders, the nurses, the doctors, anybody who is intricately involved in being a first responder needs to take a moment, sit back, and recognize that statistics matter, numbers matter, and
truth matters.
Truth matters. When you think of only 2% of 54 million resulting in, you know, because everybody right now is programmed to think every call is going to be violent. Every call could result in my death. Yeah. No, statistically, no. Most calls, and again, 2% of 54 million, I can't do the math real quick, but that's not very many.
Yeah, I'd call that small.
I would call it very small. So just keep doing what you're doing. Things like what Dr. G is doing. Keep believing in why you started, why you put your name on the application. Go out and make somebody's life better. Make their day better. Leave this world better than you found it. And don't ever, ever let somebody turn you cynical or influence you when the statistics do not bear out that that's what the truth is right now. Stick to the truth. Don't ever forget who you are and why you started this. I can't thank people. Again, Dr. G, it just makes me want to run out of this door, and I want to call my doctors, I want to call the firefighters, and I want to remind them, thank you for what you did all those years ago and all the other calls that I don't know how many lives you've saved. Darren, you've saved countless lives. I was involved in some homicide cases that I'm very proud of that at least brought, I might not have saved a life, but I brought closure to a family. And you know what? Those things matter. And that's our legacy, is just, we've done good. Let's now do better. God bless each and every one of you. Stay safe. We will see you next week.
Batch Boys. Thanks for listening to Batch Boys. Stories, insights, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Batch Boys. Heard weekly and worldwide on Star Worldwide networks and all mobile devices. Batch Boys.